Micheál Martin has just finished a four-day official visit to China. On Monday, he met with President Xi Jinping in Beijing, and by all accounts, the trip has been a glowing success. But how much do these official trips actually accomplish, and does Ireland's famous soft power really make much of an impact in the world? It's News Talk Daily. I'm Shane Beattie. It's fair to say it's been an eventful week geopolitically, with Donald Trump and Nicolas Maduro making most of the headlines. But quietly beavering away in the background was our own Micheál Martin as he pressed the flesh in Beijing. Just as he did in the Oval Office last year, the Taoiseach was careful not to comment on the latest developments.
Our view is that, first of all, we never accepted the legitimacy of the Maduro regime. And it was a particularly brutal and repressive regime, and that created its own challenges, and particularly then on the whole narcotics front and other activities. So there were real issues there. That said, we wanted a peaceful and transition from that regime to a democratic one that would be decided by the people of Venezuela. So that would be our perspective on that.
The trip came off the back of an internal study by the Department of Foreign Affairs into the government's diplomatic soft power. The report has created a bit of a stir by suggesting our diplomats could take lessons from the likes of Boyzone. More on that later. But just how much is achieved by these visits? And does Ireland's soft power pack much of a punch internationally? Joining me to discuss all of this is former Irish Ambassador to France, Rory Montgomery. Rory, you're very welcome to News Talk Daily.
Delighted to be here.
So let's talk about the China trip, first of all. Not quite as iconic as a trip to the Washington, to the White House, but how valuable is a trip like that, a trip for a Taoiseach to take in China?
Well, it's not unprecedented. Bertie Ahern, Brian Cowan, Enda Kenny all made similar visits in the past. Without exaggerating the profound long-term importance of these visits, they mean a lot to small countries in particular, because they afford an opportunity first to put oneself in the sights, if you like, of a big power like China, with which we would have, you know, a less natural relationship than we would with the US, say. It's an opportunity then to raise any practical bilateral issues, trade or whatever, with the interlocutor. And it's also very important for people on the ground in China, in this case, for the embassy, because it means that they are talking to very senior interlocutors in preparing the visit and the follow-up to the visit, and it helps to put them on the map as well. So I think there's been a custom over years for the Taoiseach of the day to make visits of this kind. I remember travelling with Bertie Ahern to India and Dubai back in the day, and you know, they would have had similar purposes. And of course, there's also the very important trade dimension, not to be forgotten.
And when you think back to those India-Dubai visits, can you say now that they were a success and that they achieved something?
I think they were of value, principally from an economic point of view. I mean, obviously, India was at that point a growing geopolitical power, but it wouldn't have been on, or it wouldn't be on, the same level as China. With Dubai, it was overwhelmingly trade and economic. It's very hard to know, because you very hard to take a particular visit or event out of the context of the wider, longer-term flow of relationships.
Yeah, I've done two trips to the White House with the Taoiseach for St. Patrick's Day, and the White House itself and the Oval Office is one thing, but there's all of these trade events that surround it. And the only way I could describe it is you can feel deals being done in the room. You know, when a Taoiseach walks into a room and you have different businesses there from the US and from Ireland, you can see the business cards being handed around, but you can feel a buzz being created, and you can feel there's even small business deals being done. Is that really the true value of it?
I think that's a big part of it. And it's interesting, because the previous president, Michael D. Higgins, was very uncomfortable with the business and economic aspects of these visits. He didn't really like it. It wasn't his natural milieu. But you are right. I mean, these business connections are important. It's not that people necessarily are meeting each other for the very first time. But again, visits of this kind tend to crystallise relationships.
And people think that these visits just sort of happen or it's very informal, but there's an awful lot of work. Even with the Washington visit every St. Patrick's Day, the work goes on for a year beforehand to make these visits happen.
Yes, I wouldn't say necessarily as long as a year, but certainly for several months, and it gets increasingly intensive as you get nearer. You have, obviously, as I said, the people in the embassy or the consulates, you know, fully engaged with this, but also at home as well, especially for Patrick's Day. It's not just the Taoiseach going to the White House. There are ministers going all over the States. So the Department of Foreign Affairs, for example, would do a huge amount of work in preparing briefing and speaking notes, arranging events for a slew of ministers.
Mm. I saw this week that the Chinese media, Michael Martin, was front page news across all the daily newspapers in China. They were selling it as this is China's gateway to Europe by having this connection with Ireland. I'm just wondering, though, behind the scenes, is the language different to publicly what we see? Like, will Michael Martin have said things privately to Xi Jinping that we won't know about?
I don't know, obviously, in this case. I'd be a little surprised. I remember, you know, once when, again, when a previous Taoiseach went, I won't say which one, and, you know, it was claimed afterwards that he had raised human rights with his Chinese interlocutor. A colleague of mine who was on the visit said, well, that must have been when I wasn't paying attention. So I think in general, these discussions are often rather rather formal and, if you like, even pre-planned. Now, obviously, with Trump, it's a totally different question because you never quite know what's going to come out of his mouth. But in general, these things are, to an extent, pre-cooked. But an amount depends then on the relationship which is built up, you know, in a meeting.
We bang on a lot about Ireland's soft power. Now, I have wondered before if we have the hardest soft power in the world, because for such a small country, it does seem like we have this remarkable access. But do we have soft power? How do you define that soft power?
Well, I think the term soft power was originally developed by an American political scientist, Joseph Nye, and he was talking about the US in this case, which has lots of hard power, obviously, but it also had soft power in terms of its cultural reach across the world, its adherence to, you know, human rights standards, etc. For smaller countries, yes, it is a way of getting oneself on the map. Ireland has a number of advantages here. First of all, we are English-speaking, which means that our culture is more easily accessible by other countries across the world. I mean, easier to be Irish than to be Czech or Danish or whatever. Secondly, then in the States in particular, but not just in the States, Australia, New Zealand, there are large Irish diasporas which maintain an awareness of Ireland and Irish culture throughout the whole year. And we are fortunate, I think, in having aspects of our culture recognised, in particular traditional music, I would say, and maybe at a different level, literature. We saw during the week the rather extraordinary revelation that Xi Jinping had been sustained by an Irish novel, The Gadfly, of the 1890s, of which I had never heard. But looking into it, it turns out that it was hugely popular in in communist countries because it told the story of a sort of anti-imperialist struggle back in the 1840s in Italy. So you never quite know where you're going to find these connections.
So soft power still means that you can have sway.
Well, I don't know about sway. I wouldn't say sway, but I'd say it puts the country more clearly in people's consciousness. And it also means that you can have, you know, it can help in making individual contacts. For example, I mean, I'm not so sure about Boyzone and still less in 2026, the Cranberries, who are mentioned in this document. But for example, when I was in Chicago, we had U2 visiting. And there was huge demand for U2 tickets. And so we as consulate were able to get some from the management and invite key people who were generally very, very grateful.
Mm.
And very often people are also anxious to have events to which they can bring their families.
Yes.
And that can make a big difference as well.
Yes.
So I wouldn't say sway, but I would say visibility.
Yeah. The reason we're mentioning music and Boyzone is this internal Department of Foreign Affairs report, which kind of recommended that we lean into our musicians, we lean into our literature.
Yeah, I don't really know that this said anything which wouldn't have been sort of second nature to diplomats for many, many years. Again, as I say, in my previous postings in France, for example, Irish culture was a major kind of calling card in a place like Paris, as you can imagine. It's a big calling card in Britain and the States. to remember the past. I remember Maeve Binchy, for example, going to visit Barbara Bush when she was the wife of the then American president. John McCain would occasionally come to events in the embassy where there were book readings or whatever. So it's not new. The hardest part, I think, is also then going beyond, if you like, the well-known mainstream, in some cases slightly tired, connections. I know that our embassy in Berlin, for instance, has done a lot to sort of present, if you like, more innovative, more sort of avant-garde Irish artists to a somewhat different public. And that's important as well.
Yeah, and then you think of Joe Biden, who would constantly quote Seamus Heaney. So I suppose that's another example of it too. Now, are we uniquely placed in Ireland? Because it feels like the world is being carved up in a whole different way right now. Are we uniquely placed being a sort of rich Western country, English-speaking, with no colonial past?
Well, I think, again, a friend of mine who used to serve at the United Nations used to say, well, look, we're simply another rich white country as far as most people are concerned. I do think we have parlayed our development programme into some level of influence and impact. The colonial point is an interesting one because, yes, I mean, it's something we have been able to trade on. But obviously, as time goes by, it's now, 70 years since the great wave of decolonization in Asia and Africa.
Yeah.
And so that comparison is a bit sort of improbable. Funnily enough, I mean, you can find these connections in unexpected places. The former Israeli prime minister back in the 80s and 90s, Yitzhak Shamir, his nom de guerre, if you like, was Michael, after Michael Collins. So the Israelis saw themselves as fighting against the British rulers, just as we had done before. So, not unique. I mean, just to say one thing, I think the fact that we are a neutral country has no relevance whatever.
Okay.
This idea that it gives us a particular platform, I don't think other countries would see that at all.
Why do you think that?
Well, because it's seen as our own business, A. B, we're very much seen as part of the EU and the EU bloc. But C, if you look at other countries like Norway again, or Finland or Denmark, Sweden, they do a lot, more than we do in many ways, in terms of peace building, aid, and so on. And the fact that they're members of NATO doesn't prevent them from doing so. So I think it's exaggerated, to be honest, you know. And indeed, there are some places probably, especially nowadays, where Irish neutrality is seen in a more negative light.
Interesting you mentioned Israelis there, because I'm thinking Israel, and Ireland's a small country, obviously, and we talk about this soft power. The last trip that Leo Varadkar did to Washington as Taoiseach, the lead up to it and every single day he was there was focused on, would he put pressure on Joe Biden on Gaza? Every single news clip that I filed, every article in the paper was, what sort of pressure would he apply to Gaza? It was very clear when we went into the White House, Joe Biden wanted to focus on Paddy Whackery and having a hoolie. And you did get the sense, should we just kind of shut up a little bit on this issue because this is not what the Americans wanted to hear?
Well, I think it's difficult. I mean, the Gaza issue is particularly tricky because, first of all, obviously there are strong opinions in Ireland, and probably the large majority of the public would support a fairly hard line on Israel. At the same time, and while opinion in the US is shifting, there's still an extremely strong pro-Israel lobby, very strong in Congress, very strong in the administration. And I would say that, we sort of would want to be sort of traveling a bit under the radar on this. There have already been, threats, if you like, or at least complaints by leading American political figures, Senator Lindsey Graham, for example. And I think, the view is that we need to be careful about this. I remember, again, going to Washington in 2018, I think it was, mainly to talk about Brexit. But in my meeting with the State Department, that was all fine. But they then were very emphatic in expressing their opposition to the Occupied Territories Bill, which had just been introduced by Francis Black at that time. So one has to calibrate these things. And if one has very specific, concrete national interests, to be ranging over the affairs of the world, it can be tricky. I mean, in a way, this is expected to some extent. I'm sure Biden would have been briefed that this was a concern in Ireland, but he certainly wouldn't be expecting us to major on it, and I very much doubt if we did.
Back to the soft power, how much of a role does the diaspora around the world play in that, do you think?
I think it's not insignificant at all, especially in the Northern Ireland peace process. I think, yes, there were, the Irish-American community was on the whole supportive. you know, off the peace process, although there were elements who still remained, you know, quite attached to dissident republicanism. But what was more important, in a way, was that you had a set, really from the 70s onwards, of really significant figures who were Irish-American and had a sense of their heritage. Ted Kennedy, Tip O'Neill, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, and then subsequently, you know, a range of other people. So I think that was really crucial. Now, I think that's a wasting asset as time goes by. There are fewer prominent Irish Americans, or fewer people with, you know, who are with consciousness of their Irish Americans. They may have an Irish name, but it might be four generations or so removed.
We don't hear much about the undocumented Irish as much anymore. This used to be a big issue every single year.
Yes, I suppose, in a way, we never really, in my view, got a full handle on the scale of the problem. And I can only assume that at the moment, given the US approach to immigration, there is a sense that it's not wise for us to be highlighting this issue. I mean, there were attempts some years ago to build on the success of the Green Card initiatives of Donnelly and Morrison back in the 90s. But then I think it became pretty clear that Ireland wouldn't get any kind of special deal. So to that extent, you know, we were dependent on things that should be done, you know, for countries with which there are far larger flows, of which there are much larger flows. But this is not a moment to be pressing Trump on immigration.
Right. Where do we possibly align ourselves now? Because we have those very, very strong links, obviously, to America, but then we have, obviously, our connection with the EU as well. I was mentioning there, it feels like the world is being carved up in a different way now, and really it feels like it is Russia, China, US. What do we do diplomatically?
Well, I think with the United States, we have to continue to make every effort to maintain our links. We are extraordinary within the EU. I mean, US trade and investment are far more important for Ireland than for any other EU member state, which puts us in an awkward position when the EU as a whole may be considering countermeasures against the US. Now, it didn't take any in the end, particularly on tariffs, but it puts us in an awkward position. The core of our foreign policy has to be Europe. You know, it's our biggest sort of trading partner, especially for, you know, non-multinationals. It's also aligned with us generally on values and on sort of geopolitical concerns, on the security of Europe. These things affect us very, very deeply. And the EU itself, of course, is in this difficult position of trying, on the one hand, not to get offside with Trump, but equally knowing that there are fairly major economic tensions with China, but at the same time, you know, not breaking ties with China, and far from it. And so, you know, it's a balancing act. And in a way, the EU on a larger scale is doing sort of what Ireland is doing nationally.
Yeah, a balancing act for everybody then, because if you take, we're trying to work with America on a Ukraine deal, but then we have this threat to Greenland, which is threatening to cut off effectively a bit of Europe and give it to America as well. And you have the threat coming from Russia and China too. It just feels like you can't win in this situation.
No, it's extraordinarily difficult. And I think the real issue which has been highlighted is that Europe, not Ireland in particular, but Ireland is a very small part of the story, that Europe has not invested in security and defence, and it finds itself in a position where it is absolutely dependent on US involvement to stop the Russian advance in Ukraine. And equally with Greenland, one of the reasons that people have not spoken out more strongly about the Greenland issue, I think, is precisely the fear of antagonising Trump and his henchmen. You know, I think the EU finds itself in a very difficult position. And also, I think it was said very frankly back in the summer of last year by the Director General for Trade of the EU that one of the reasons it hadn't struck back more firmly against the Trump tariffs was fear of what the read across to Ukraine might be. So it does put us in a, Europe as a whole, in a sticky position. But yet making progress on these issues internally is quite difficult for lots of reasons. And there are different attitudes and instincts within the European Union about how to deal with these questions.
Given the way geopolitics is at the moment, would you fancy being an ambassador now?
Well, I felt I had a most interesting career, and I was in France, as you said, and I was also ambassador to the European Union during the financial crisis, which was a pretty hairy time to be there, as you can imagine. But I think if I were certainly younger and more of my career to go, yes, I'd absolutely like it.
Okay, very good. Well, listen, a pleasure to talk to you. Rory Montgomery, former Irish ambassador to France and the EU. Thanks so much for joining us here on News Talk Daily. That's it from the podcast for today and indeed for the week. If you missed any of our episodes this week, including our podcast about William Shakespeare and the new film Hamlet, you can listen back on the Go Loud player. And if you do go see Hamlet in the cinema over the weekend, don't forget to send us your reviews. The email address is newstalkdaily@newstalk.com. But for now, from me, Shane Beattie, bye-bye.